Take a look at interest groups. Now, there's two ways we can deal with this. One way is we can give it what I call the introductory lick and a promise without getting too deep. And the other way is we can turn it into an entire semester course, which I have had at the graduate level. Either way is fun, but in between it doesn't work real well. So, Ms. Blackwelder, what I plan to do is give you the interest groups 101, not interest groups 537. Fair enough? If at any point some of this you say, hey, I'd like to know more about this, don't hesitate, because I can either give you lots of more information, or I can refer you to any one of the thousands or so books that have been published on the issue. Oh, I'm sorry. Talking about organized collection of people that are bound together by some shared attitude or concern, they're going to make demands on political institutions in order to realize their goals. Now, the meeting that I went to Friday and Saturday was Friday with the Legislative Committee for the Texas Community College Teachers Association, and that was held conjointly with the faculty leaders session of the Texas Community College Teachers Association. Is that an interest group? Sure. What's the common goal? The improvement, funding, and any other issues that are related to community colleges. Are there any political institutions on which TCCTA is going to be making demands in order to try to realize their goals? Yeah, the Texas Legislature, the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, and peripherally Congress. We've always had interest groups, and they're perhaps better organized than they have been in a long time. Kind of a side funny here. One of the speakers was talking about was a lawyer that represents the association in employment issues, and he started out, said, now the key case in this particular issue is a case called Perry versus Sinderman, which took place quite a long time ago, back in 1972, when I was a second year law student. He said, of course, none of you in here probably were involved at that particular point in time. I didn't raise my hand and say, yeah, actually I was a member of the association then, and was involved with the legislative committee, and blah, blah, blah. I just thought, you know, better to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fossil. And you know, this lawyer looked kind of old to me, and I had to be at least 10 years older than he is. Moving right along. People at my table were gigging me in the ribs going, ha, ha. I thought, do it again and you're dead. And let's analyze interest groups. And here are the four characteristics we're going to look at. Level of involvement, how their membership is distributed, how they're structured. All organizations don't structure themselves the same way. And you pick a structure which will maximize your advantages and minimize your disadvantages. And what happens to organizations that guess wrong? Yeah, nonverbal but very accurate. They don't succeed. And then there's some organizational patterns that you need to be at least familiar with. So when you're analyzing an interest group, now I had an extra credit project at one time, and I might dust it back off, where you pick an institute, where you pick an interest group and do an analysis of it. Look at it from the standpoint of its involvement in the political process, its distribution of membership, its membership structure, its organizational patterns, and then I added a few other characteristics on there, like how much money can it raise and who does it spend it on. Because pooping off your money is not a good idea. You want to spend it where there's maximum advantage. Now, what's going to surprise you is there are relatively few groups that are primarily and almost completely political. Because by definition, most interest groups are organized around some non-political purpose, but politics is important to secondary but important to the goals they're trying to achieve. Community College Teachers Association does not exist primarily for political reasons. It exists as an association of community college teachers for all sorts of other practices. In February, we'll have our state convention, state meeting in Houston this time, and there are all sorts of section meetings, political science meetings, history meetings, associate degree nurse meetings. You know, almost every discipline that's taught in the community college, there will be a section meeting where you get together and share knowledge and get to share ideas about what happened and how it works. Now, there are a lot of groups that are, in fact, they probably are the most numerous, which are essentially non-political, like Rotary Club, Kiwanis, etc. But when the right set of circumstances arise and the right situation arises, they can become very political. Now, those of you who had my federal government course, you heard this analogy, but maybe you didn't remember it. Has anybody in here ever kept bees? Besides me. I used to have a number of hives of bees. Keep trying to persuade my wife that I would love to have another hive of bees to put out behind the shop. She's not too sure she likes the idea, but she's warming to the idea. Now, there's some things you need to know about beekeeping, about bees. This is not going to be a lecture on beekeeping. It's just I'm using one little piece of information. First off, what percentage of the bees in a beehive are of the same gender? 99% or better percent of the bees are females. They are non-fertile females. There's only one fertile female called the queen. And they keep the drones around for when they need to repopulate the hives. And in the winter, and they can make the drones without a problem. And so what they do in the winter when it gets cold is they throw the drones out to starve. Unlike most bureaucratic organizations, you get to throw the drones out and let them starve. At any rate, there's one key thing to remember. And this is true. Now, the following is a very sexist comment, but you might find it accurate. I have discovered that in beekeeping, as in life, alienating the females is not a good idea. What happens to a hive if you agitate it? They swarm out and they become... Now, bees don't sting you just for the heck of it. Wasps will, but bees don't, because it kills a bee to sting you. It tears their stinger, goes into the skin, and when they try to take away, their abdomen is torn off and they'll die. So they don't just dump in and sting people for the heck of it. It's to defend the colony. Generally, to defend the colony or to defend themselves. So as long as you don't really alienate them or agitate them or make them think that the colony is in danger, you're not in danger. Now, I always worked bees with protective equipment, that is to say the overalls, the gloves with the rubber cuffs, and you know, so that they had to work at it to sting me. But I know a lot of beekeepers that the only thing they ever wore was a bee veil, just to keep them away from your face. Not worrying about their hands, because they, you know, I get stung once or twice, but that's no big deal. Really didn't. Miss King, you have any idea where I'm going on this? Good. Caroline? Any idea where I'm going? If you're a politician, treat interest groups like you would a hive of bees. Don't unnecessarily honk them off. Because if you agitate them, they're likely to respond in ways that you're not happy about. Okay? So if you keep that analogy in your mind, you see politicians, when they deal with interest groups, normally handle them just like you do bees. Very carefully, non-threatening manner. Fair enough. Does that stick in your mind? Good analogy. Well, your membership can be local or national or something in between. There's a Galveston Oleander Society. Oleander societies, by definition, are generally pretty local, aren't they? How far north do you think you could grow oleanders in Texas? Let's put it this way. How far north can you grow oleanders without bringing them in during the winter? Just a little north of Houston is about the limit. If you get weather, if you get temperatures that are going to be consistently below 28 degrees, oleanders can't handle it. Kind of like citrus. We grow citrus in Galveston. On the rare occasions that we have temperatures that drop below 25 degrees, it's not good for citrus, but we don't have that very often. You're all too young to remember this, but at one point I had this wonderful Satsuma orange back behind my house, and then the great freeze of the winter of 1983 hit. Temperature dropped to 18 degrees in Galveston. Yeah. I had 120 something Satsuma oranges, and not only did it freeze the tree, it froze the oranges on the tree. It's pretty sad. I guess I don't learn. I went ahead and planted another Satsuma in my backyard 2 years ago, and I've got 31 Satsumas on it that'll be getting ready sometime between now and Christmas. National groups. Now, what difference does it make what your distribution is? What do you think? Would a local group have much impact on national issues?
No.
Is a group that's organized on a national basis but has relatively few members at the local level going to have any real swoop with something like Galveston City Council? So you got to match your members to the kinds of issues that you're dealing with. Fair enough? What kind of an association, what kind of structure, membership redistribution does the Texas Community College Teachers have? Obviously Texas. Throughout the entire state, yes, there are 50 community college districts in Texas that cover most of the state. We have just about 6,000 members. What percentage of community college teachers probably belong to TCCTA? Majority? Minority? There are about 50,000 community college teachers throughout the state in one capacity or another. So it's a minority. Do they speak for all community college teachers? Well, that makes it an interesting question. You always would like to have more members because that gives you more money and it gives you a little more clout when you start dealing with legislators. But if you're a legislator, you have to make an assumption, don't you? Either this group really speaks for all those people who don't pay $45 a year dues, or it speaks for the most active members who could, in the right situation, stir up the rest of them. Now, let me talk real quickly about how bees communicate. Anybody know this answer?
By buzzing mouth? Smell?
I can't hear you.
Is it smell?
It is smell. They release a hormone smell called ephemerone, which says, we're being attacked. And when one or two release that, another four, five, and six, ten, and pretty soon if the whole hive has released it, they're all agitated. Now, been a lot of folks study this in some degree of detail about how what level of ephemerones have to be there before the whole hive gets agitated. Just one or two of them upset's not going to make a whole big deal. What do you think happened the time I dropped a brood chamber? I made it from the back of my parents' house to the front yard in record time, and that was with complete bee suit and wearing rubber boots. My Uncle Sim looked out the window and saw me going by and said, "God, I didn't know the professor could run that fast." Well, normally he couldn't, but I had about 400 bees trying to eat me alive. They were not happy. Fortunately, the ephemerons dissipated and they calmed back down, and I could go and put the box back where it belonged. Now, the Texas Community College Teachers Association has an individual membership structure. That is to say, it's individuals that fill out the membership application, pay the dues, the college doesn't do it, etc. On the other side of the coin, there is another association called the Texas Association, the Texas Junior College Association, that's made up primarily of presidents. And how do you get to be a member of TAC? You're president of a community college. Who pays the dues for TAC? The college. If you cease to be a president, do you belong to TAC? No, because the college does. And the president is the representative of the college, but technically not the member. The colleges belong, not the individuals. Did that make sense to you? TADA, Texas Automobile Dealers Association. It's the dealership that pays the dues, not the individual dealer. Are we making sense? Groups or entities belong. Now, there are a few hybrid organizations where both persons and groups can belong. With few exceptions, they don't tend to be terribly successful, because you have really a conflict. You either work for the members or you work for the group. If this were the interest group's 537 course, we'd spend at least an hour or better looking at this in some degree of detail and the studies that have been done. But the truth of the matter is, you really don't give a rat's tail about it, do you? Can you name me a unitary organization? Only one national organization exists. Members belong directly to it. Now, actually, TCCTA is a unitary organization at the state level. Fair enough? Our federated organization, where we have local, state, and national chapters, or local state chapters if it happens to be. Would you like an example of one of those? Mm-hmm. Okay, my wife is a member of the Texas Nurses Association. She also happens to belong to a local organization called the Galveston Association of Advanced Practice Nurses. There is a National Nurses Association. What is the advantage of a federated format? Can you bring to bear pressure or information at both the local, state, and national level that way? Labor unions are organized that way. You have local unions, you have the state organization, and you have the national union. Now, I had a student in my class many years ago, and I asked them to make a list of any organizations they might happen to belong to. And he rather proudly, and I have no problem with this, said, "I belong to the FLCIO. Well, after class, I had to say, "No, you don't belong to the FLCIO. Por qué?
What is the FLCIO?
American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations.
No idea.
Only groups can belong to the FLCIO. Only unions can belong to the FLCIO. He was a member of the local electricians union. The state FLCIO, only unions, the groups, can belong. When you get your membership, you're not a member of the FFL-CIO, you are a member of the local union. And the local labor council here is made up of the affiliated unions, such as the building trades, electricians, pipe fitters, carpenters, etc. Did I mention electricians too? Electricians. Okay, so you can belong to the local union as an individual. Remember we talked about individuals versus groups? It's a hybrid organization. FFL-CIO statewide and FFL-CIO nationally are group-only organizations, but the local unions are individual-only organizations. Does that make sense for everybody? Again, if this were interest groups 537, we'd look at that in a lot of detail, but there's no need to. Now, the last one I want to talk about on this list is a little confusing. Unlike the FFL-CIO, which has a whole range of purposes and goals, and then the individual unions have their particular purposes and goals, a confederated organization is an organization that shares one significant goal, and various groups are affiliated with it. And they're pushing to achieve that goal, and if they achieve that goal, they may go out of existence because there's no particular any reason for them to continue to exist. Ms. King, is this making any sense to you? All right, let me give you an example. As I was going through, I think I told most of you may know my father died in May. And as I've been cleaning out the closet and whatnot, I ran across his vest for the Sportsman's Clubs of Texas. Now, you've never heard of it, because it hasn't been in existence now for about 30 years. Back in the 1970s, the Sportsman's Clubs of Texas was a confederated organization that was pushing to get the legislature to give the Texas Parks and Wildlife regulatory authority. Now, at that point in time, all game and fish laws in Texas were passed by the legislature, not by rule, administrative regulation by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Right. This meant if you needed, let me just give you one quick example of where this causes a problem. Oh, by the way, on my way to Austin, I saw three dead deer that had been run into by cars between Columbus and Bastrop. The general predictions are this is going to be an extremely good deer year. Why? If you had been attempting to predict what the deer population of that part of Texas was going to look like a year ago, would you have been successful? No. If you'd even been trying to predict the deer population in 2015, you might have missed it. What happened in the early winter and spring to make sure that there's an extremely good fawn, that the fawn crop was good and that the survival rate on fawns was very high? We got some rain. Went from a serious drought to, and the oak trees went wild and produced tons of acorns, literally tons of acorns. Why is that important? Deer are not grazers, they're browsers. Have any idea what I just said? I mean, you heard me, but you have any idea what it meant? They don't eat grass. Only in dire circumstances will they eat grass. Their teeth are not designed to do it, their digestive tract is not designed to handle it. They'll starve to death trying to eat grass. That's why you don't see deer out on the open prairie. They are strictly creatures of the forest. And certain kinds of forest, where there's oak and hickory and twigs and whatnot available. Okay, they're browsers. And goats also, by the way, are browsers. Got a funny story on that, but we don't have time to tell it. So all of a sudden, when do, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, when does Bambi's mother have her babies? Early spring. And whether there's lots of acorns left over, the oak trees drop their acorns usually in October, November, December period. If the female deer are able to fatten up during October, November, December, they will become fertile and conceive and have fawns. Okay, now the whole purpose of this lecture, or that part of the lecture, is to tell you there's no way the legislature can guess 2 years ahead of time what the conditions are going to be and set the limits for deer. So giving the Parks and Wildlife Department regulatory authority to be able to set those limits based on what the biologists are telling them is the situation is critical. So we had bass fishermen, saltwater fishermen, duck hunters, deer hunters, all in coalition, Sportsmen's Clubs of Texas, to push for regulatory authority for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Is there any reason to maintain that organization once the success has occurred? No. The deer hunters continue to be the deer hunters, the duck hunters are the duck hunters, and whatnot. They revert to their primary objective. Now, if you're paying attention, you will see coalitions that are formed of various interest groups to push for particular legislative goals. That's a confederated type organization. Everybody clear on that? They're not really common compared to the unitary or federal. But they can be terribly successful for what reason? I know it's unfair to ask you to think, particularly this early in the morning, right? Do they tap into a much broader constituency that can have more of an impact on legislators or administrators than any single small group could have? You follow where I'm taking you on that? Each one of those groups has its particular area of focus and pressure, and they can bring it to bear and achieve their goals. All right, just a little paragraph. This is the way a unitary organization works. You have the association, you have the individual members, no middleman. This is the way the federated organization belongs. Local, state, and national. Now, members can belong to local, state, and national chapters, or the local chapter can automatically belong to the state chapter, can belong to the national chapter, like the FFL-CIO. If this were interest groups 537, we'd spend a little more time on it, but this is all we want to do. And then you have the Confederated, which is the umbrella organization with all of the related groups belonging to it. Now, let's start to wrap it up. Of all the different kinds of groups, which tend to have the most power? Business, economic groups, or ideological groups?
Business?
Well, it depends on the issue, doesn't it? If we're talking about economic issues, then probably economic groups are going to have the greatest impact. If we're talking about ideological type issues, then groups that are committed to a particular perspective are going to care. Now, when they cross purposes, when they become ideological and economic, either come into conflict or when they coalesce, you can get very different results. Let me, at the risk of stepping on somebody's toes, The legislature in the state of Arkansas passed a series of really anti-gay bills. It began to have, The legislature in Arkansas passed a bunch of anti-immigrant bills, really making it tough on immigrants. What industry in Arkansas was heavily dependent on immigrant labor? If we did the same analysis for Arkansas that we did for Texas about what are the primary economic interests, what is probably the one of the very top economic interests in Arkansas?
Construction?
That's a secondary. Okay. Construction only occurs when the economy is growing.
Agriculture.
And what is the primary agricultural product of Arkansas?
I have no idea.
Would it be fair to say that Arkansas is a chicken state? Who do you think worked most of Arkansas's poultry processing plants? Immigrant labor, migrant labor. And when it got to be known that you want to stay away from Arkansas because they've got all sorts of very anti-immigrant laws, what happened to the poultry industry in Arkansas? They began to have serious problems. They had chickens they couldn't process. Several of the processing companies, Tyson in particular, said we're going to shut down our operations in Arkansas unless the legislature changes the law, drops those laws. And the governor called a special session to repeal the laws because Tyson was one of the largest employers of the state and one of the largest taxpayers in the state. Now, do we see how ecological and ideological can sometimes come into conflict with one another? Minorities, we talk about ideological groups, minorities, public interest groups. This is political interest groups 537, there's a whole week's worth of work we could put on that, and I'm just not going to do it. So let's wrap this up. What are the factors that affect the organizational success of a group? Is size the most important issue? Not really. There's two issues that have to be taken in combination. All of these are factors. Size and cohesion are important. That is to say, the degree of focus, the degree of unity. Now, I have got to admit that on occasion I have been very, very tacky and picked someone out who's a very nice young person and asked the question, how important is size? And then after they turn red, I say, now, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm looking at interest groups. It ain't the most important thing. Now, obviously, a group that has no members is not going to be terribly influential, but a group that has, here's what happens when a group develops an awfully lot of members. The cohesion of the group begins to deteriorate. Does that make sense to you? You can't keep it. I'm going to take another real silly analogy for a second, and I'm watching the watch. What do you know about sheep herding?
It's a pain. It's a pain in the rear.
Did you know that the size of the number of dogs and shepherds that it takes to control a flock is geometrically is a geometric function of the size of the flock? Ms. Shepherd, do you have any idea what I just said? If you double the size of the flock, you don't need twice as many shepherds or twice as many dogs. You need four times as many shepherds and four times as many dogs, because unlike cattle, sheep develop their own way of thinking, and if the flock gets beyond a certain size, believe it or not, doctoral dissertations have been done on this. but for other reasons. Once the flock gets beyond a certain size, it ceases to be a cohesive entity and becomes a number of cohesive entities, all of which want to operate separately. That making sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
So you get a flock above a certain size, to any stimuli, they're going to separate and go in several different directions simultaneously. All right, enough of that analogy. But believe it or not, I read several articles of people who were talking about what the maximum size of an interest group to maintain cohesion could be. And they used this data from sheep herding to kind of make the point. Where your members are distributed. The economic resources, obviously, this is going to be stupid, okay? Which of the two do you think would have the biggest impact? The Association of Panhandlers or the Association of Business?
Probably of business.
They've got the economic resources to have an impact.
Yeah.
Now, quality of leadership is terribly important. Some groups are huge, but their leadership sucks. They couldn't organize a 3-car funeral. Reputation. What their reputation is with legislators is terribly important. Or with, you know, are they normally thought of as a group of lying thieves? At this stage of the game, we look at size of membership, cohesion, geographical distribution, particularly economic resources. Wall Street hedge fund operators ought to have a real advantage, shouldn't they? But what's their reputation? Alibaba and his 40 thieves probably would have a higher reputation at this stage of the game, particularly after they crashed the economy in 2008. And how important is the public support for the goals the organization has? What do you think? Now, I've used this example in other classes, and I'm going to use it again. If you put all of these factors together, one of the groups that is massively successful is Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. If you look at legislative success, their chances of how they win when they push an issue in the legislature or in Congress, they almost always win. I was paying very close attention to the legislature when the bill came up to reduce the drinking blood alcohol level from 0.10 to 0.08. Now, how many of you have studied that? What is the level of, shall we say, ability of people to function well? Where is the break point? It depends on the individual, obviously, but for people as a whole, somewhere between 0.06 and 0.08. When you get to 1.0, it's not an arithmetic differentiation. It's a geometric differentiation. At 0.10, a person is half as capable as they are as at 0.08. It depends on the person, but average. So the Texas legal definition of drunken driver or driving under the influence was 0.10 until MAD got involved. And when you looked at the hearing, the legislative hearing in which the bill to drop it to 0.08 came up, the economic interest aligned to keep it at 0.10 were the bars, the Texas Wholesale Dealers Association, the Texas Beer Distributors Association, the Texas Restaurant Association. I mean, some heavy, heavy hitters economically. And I happened to be in Austin the day that hearing took place, and I could not believe that not a single economic group got up and testified against the 0.08 bill. So I did a little investigating, and I found out that the chairman of the committee had called all of the different groups in and said, we're going to have a hearing on this, and you are not going to oppose it. Let me explain why. We've had some polls done, and the public is generally in major support of 0.08. This committee deals with a lot of issues that are of importance to the alcohol industry. And if you insist that the members of this committee vote against this bill, you're going to get most of them beaten, and the people who will be on the committee from this point on may not necessarily be your friends. So you just decide what's important to you. Now let me explain a little bit. If you run a bar, you can't go out and negotiate directly with the distiller or the brewery to buy your product. You have to go through the middlemen. That is Texas law. So the Texas Beer Distributors Association, the Texas Liquor Packaged, they're heavily in support of that law. Now, if I were a bar operator, a restaurant operator like Landry's, I would love to negotiate directly with the brewery to have that stuff delivered without having the middleman take a cut. And there's all sorts of these little arrangements, any one of which could start to topple. Everybody understand where we're going with this? It can get complicated. Why do people join groups? Well, material benefits is one reason. Social or solidarity, ideological shared beliefs. Which of these do you think is important for TCCTA, Texas Community College Teachers Association? All of them. If you get a letter one of these days from some group that's offering, let me just use this as an example. Many years ago, more than I like to remember, I got a letter from AARP. What's AARP? American Association of Retired Persons.
Yeah.
Offering me membership, and I was only about 50. I mean, if that's the baseline where you can join. I was only 50 at the time, and that's a few years ago. And I thought, my gosh, I'm a long way from retirement. I'm not that far away anymore, but I'm a long way away from retirement. And why would I want to join a group like that? And then I started looking at it. What are the advantages to having an ARP card?
Discounts.
Oh, yeah. Everybody see that? 10%, sometimes 20% discount. Interestingly enough, when you look at ARP's membership figures, they're really about double, in effect, what the traditional membership would be, because it's a family membership. You and your spouse both belong. Now, most of you are aware of the fact that, or at least you probably, if you saw the slides, you figure out that my wife is a little younger than myself. Okay, she's a lot younger than myself. Well, 16 years. That's not a lot, is it?
No.
Nah. Like I said, she was old enough when we got married to know what she was doing and young enough to still enjoy it. But back to where we're going. So they sent us two cards, one for me and one for her. And I gave her card. Have you ever stepped on a cat's tail in the dark?
Meow!
I got about the same reaction. And the first major trip she took, professional trip she took, and she saved about $75-$80 for the discounts, she suddenly decided that maybe she really was a good member. Is that material benefits? Yeah. Do I have solidarity meetings where I get together with old folks I'm not quite old enough for that yet. Ideological shared beliefs. Can you think of groups that are almost entirely ideologically shared beliefs? Would you put the pro-life group in that category?
Yes.
Yeah. Groups that that mix all three of those tend to be fairly successful, and TCCTA mixes the three. All right. How do groups go about having influence? Well, they can lobby. What is lobbying? That's directly communicating with people who are in a position to make policy decisions to try to influence them. Back in the 1970s, the Texas Community College Teachers Association relied entirely on citizen members to do the lobbying. Lobbying is kind of a technical skill that works, but what's the downside to that? Can they always be there when they need to be there? No. They have to take off from work to be able to go do it. Are they always necessarily knowledgeable of everything that needs to be done in the lobbying process? Can they build the kind of relationships that maybe are useful? Sometimes not. Influencing public opinion, taking out ads to influence public opinion. Filing lawsuits, strikes, pickets, getting directly involved in elections, or making campaign contributions. Now, why I have put those in bold print and put an asterisk on them is if you're a 501c3 organization, you cannot make campaign contributions. So if you go look at the Texas Ethics Commission website and see how much money Texas Community College Teachers Association has contributed to any candidates, what number are you going to find? Zero. Por qué? It's a 501c3 organization. Can TCCTA itself get involved in elections? No. Can individual members, however? Yes. And what we did at this legislative committee meeting Friday was talk about the strategy of how we're going to be able to use individual members in the lobbying effort, in the direct action effort, campaigning and campaign contributions, without involving the organization, directly. Is this making sense to you, Kathy?
Yes.
Okay. If you're going to be a lobbyist, you have to register with the Texas Ethics Commission, and I've given you their website. Now, I'm not going to ask you to memorize all of the rules and regulations that are involved in terms of who you have to report to and what you have to report to. If I hit them real quickly with the understanding that you don't have to memorize the numbers, will you just listen for a second? If you're going to spend $500 in a calendar quarter on covered expenses, you have to register and you have to report. Now, what's a covered expense? Is your transportation cost a covered expense? No. Is your lodging and meals for you alone or your representative? No. Your direct expenses are not. But if I take a legislator out to dinner, is that a covered expense?
Yes.
Yes. If I make a campaign contribution, is that a covered expense? Yes, regardless of the amount. Well, if it's over $50, it's a covered expense. Anything over $50, you have to report. When I was running for county Democratic chairman, I had one fellow walk up to me and give me a $50 bill and said, give me a penny. For a second, I said, okay, what? Why? He said, I have to report anything over $50. $49.99, I don't have to report. Give me a penny. If you have your expenses reimbursed and you spend more than $1,000 in a calendar quarter on covered expenses, you have to report. Now, if that's less than 5% of your overall time is spent, you don't have to register as a lobbyist. So, let me explain this. If I go to Austin and testify on a bill, do I have to register as a lobbyist? I don't spend any money on covered expenses, but do I have to register? No, because it's doubtful that one trip to Austin is going to constitute more than 5% of my overall compensated income. But what if I happen to work for the University of Texas and I'm camped out in Austin? Well, there's an interesting thing there. Probably not, for reasons I'll point out to you. But what if I work for Monsanto and I'm there? Do I have to report, register as a lobbyist?
Yeah.
If you're a nonprofit organization, it costs you $100 a year. Everybody else, it's $500. Remember 501c3? How many of you have seen the YMCA thing? How many of you can do that? You know, the Y? I can't do it. My wife can do it. I can't do it. I never have get the YMCA right. I kind of look like a flounder out of water. But let's make it 501c3 instead of YMCA. If it's a 501c3, whatever, it's only going to cost you $100 a year. But if it's more, if you're not, it's $500 a year. Say, I've eaten a Sir Pussycat. Citizen lobbyist versus paid lobbyist. Beeman is a paid lobbyist for the Texas Community College Association. He represents, are we a trade group, a professional association? What are we? Well, sometimes it's hard to figure out. Now, what if you have a company that does lobbying for a lot of different clients? Is that legal? Yeah. When I was working in the legislature, these were almost unheard of. A few law firms would represent more than one client, but almost unheard of. Now, there are at least 50 different hired guns in Austin, which are firms that primarily lobby. If it's an issue that's of terrible importance to your company or your group, but you don't happen to have somebody that does this full time, you can hire one of these professional firms to represent you, particularly if it's an issue that you're not going to need a representation on a long-term basis. Okay? Now, I was being a little bit unfair to you a minute ago. I asked you about UT representative. Does he have to register? No, because he's not a lobbyist legally. Governmental agencies cannot legally lobby the legislature. But they can have liaison representatives there who provide information. Anybody know Ben Raymer? Ben Raymer was the county Republican chairman when I was county Democratic chairman. My daughter's pediatrician. He and I have been very good friends for 30 plus years. He is now the governmental liaison representative for UTMB. He is a medical doctor, but he no longer practices medicine. He just practices politics. But he's not registered as a lobbyist because he's not a lobbyist. He's a governmental liaison representative. Now, I'm going to conclude this. If it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, and it lays duck eggs, can you reasonably assume it's a duck? Yes, unless it's a governmental liaison representative, which is a special subset of ducks. You've been good.